Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, thanks for coming. We're going to be talking today about some of the things that are changing in the world of philanthropy, and things are changing in the world of philanthropy. And it's going to be really important for us to understand those changes in order to be able to accommodate and to do the kinds of things that we're committed to do as an organization to fulfill our mission of really reaching others. And so we're going to take the time today to talk a little bit about what's happened in the world in the last several years, all of which you know about, and I'm just going to explain the impact in more detail perhaps than what you've heard it in the past. First of all, there has been changes in the world of philanthropy. Especially in 2008, we experienced an economic crisis. It wasn't just an American crisis, it was a worldwide crisis. We called it a recession, but it was awfully close to a depression for many people because a lot of people lost an immense amount of money. And it changed people's habits as it relates to giving and a lot of other things. I mean, many of the people that were impacted adversely by the economic crisis lost their homes, others lost their jobs. Many of them weren't prepared for an economic crisis. They had no margin whatsoever in their finances, and so many of them became in situations where houses were repossessed, just all kinds of tragic things happened, and it happened to not just one group of people, but an entire nation at one level or another. And so what happened as a result of that is the same thing that happened as a result of the Depression, because many of you have heard about the Depression because maybe your grandfathers and your fathers told you about it, as was my case. My dad and mom were born in the middle of the Depression, not born in the middle of the Depression, but actually married in the middle of the Depression. And so they had experienced the long lines. They had experienced a lot of the things that basically you see pictures of in history books these days. But they became extremely conservative, as perhaps your parents did as well. They began to not hoard money, but they began to save it. They didn't spend very much. They never bought much new. It was a lot of used clothes and all kinds of other things. And we just kind of learned to live like that, the children of the Depression era parents. And so their habits as it related to savings were improved or better than what typically ours were, because they had known the reality of loss, and they had experienced the reality of loss, and they were trying to protect themselves from something like that happening again. Well, unfortunately, the children didn't have that same experience, and so typically what happens, there's always these pendulums, you know, where you go from real conservative to real liberal, and sometimes a little bit later everything kind of settles down into a new norm. But as a child of a Depression-era family, we grew up learning how to be thrifty. And we had seen our parents do it, and we learned a little bit about that. But then as we became older and had more money, and we were able to make more money, we wanted to indulge in what it is that money could provide. And so we were able to buy a home, and we were able to buy cars and all the other kinds of things. And so we kind of went to the other extreme. And then our children tend to be a little bit like their parents. And everything changes, as you clearly know, as generations pass from generation to generation. But nobody was really expecting the kind of financial crisis that happened in 2008. And so what's happening is that we have a generation that is much more conservative. They're beginning to look like Depression-era children or families who are now responding to the Great Recession of 2008 in much the way as their parents, you know, reacted to the impact of the Depression of their era. And so people still give, but they don't give as much as they used to give, number one, because many of their gifts, especially in major capital funding efforts and so forth, many of their gifts were being amortized over a period of time. In other words, someone might give a gift to their favorite charity. Some very wealthy people made pledges on capital funding campaigns for the university from which they graduated. And they may have made a $10 million commitment, a $10 million pledge. And they were going to satisfy that over 10 years. So they were going to give $1 million a year for 10 years because they had been receiving large percentages of growth in their portfolio consistently for the previous 10 or 15 years. And so they're anticipating that everything is going to be exactly the same in the future. Well, all of a sudden, when the economy failed, they weren't able to fulfill those pledges. And interestingly enough, there was challenge after challenge presented to the courts. Is that a legal commitment? And the courts finally agreed that if they made a pledge, it was a legal commitment. And so they were responsible for fulfilling the pledge, despite the fact that they didn't have the money to do it in many situations. And there's some horror stories in the midst of all of this where, you know, people lost fortunes because they made pledges that they couldn't fulfill. And most of them came to the conclusion, we're not going to ever do that again. So a lot of campaigns were basically put on hold, you know, for several years. Many organizations weren't doing from about 2008 to 2012. There was not an organization or a major organization doing a major capital funding campaign during that period between 2008 and 2012. And then people began to get a little bit looser with their money and they began to give again, but never to the extent that they did before. So per capita income has gone down from 2008 from what it was, and is still now creeping up, but nonetheless, it's not the same as it used to be. People now who are making pledges for long-term projects are basically still giving, and they'll accept whatever amortization commitments they're being asked to consider. I mean, you can satisfy this over 3 years, but they will never typically make a commitment that they knowingly can't satisfy within 18 months. So they just stretch out the amount of money that they give. It's a little bit less per year. But they're basically making sure that they're not placed in a situation similar to what happened in 2008. And so that's the overall picture of what happened as a result of the economic crisis. And while it was bad in America, it was worse in other places. Eastern Europe was desperately hit. Countries like Iceland were virtually almost destroyed economically. And most of you can tell your stories of what it is that happened, you know, in your country and in places where you serve and people that you know. So we talk a little bit oftentimes in development about what we call the perfect storm. Many of you may have seen the movie. It was a movie that talked about a ship that was on the Atlantic Ocean and a perfect storm occurred. And the perfect storm is when two weather fronts converge at the same time at the same place. And what happened in that movie was, it was obviously the loss of a ship and basically the people that were in it, basically fishermen who were fishing for tuna on the Atlantic Ocean. Well, this is something of a perfect storm as well, because you have an economic crisis, okay, and we talked a little bit about that, converging with a demographic crisis, which almost creates the perfect storm. Now, the demographic crisis is something that in a previous session I've talked a little bit about, but let me just kind of review it quickly. In America, and it's the same in your country, the commonalities, however, may be different. But in our country, we tend to look at things generationally. And so there are like five generations that have basically lived in America today. There's the what we call the builders, those born between 1925 and 1946, okay. Most of those people were born in about 1908, but we talk about their generation as the builders. My dad was born in 1914, but he fought the war, World War II. He came back from the war. He became engaged in business like a lot of individuals did. They built a lot of the major corporations that essentially exist today. They built the foundations of a new economy that basically was as a result of the war efforts and so forth. And so they were a generation of about 60 million or so, and they built the infrastructure that basically supported the economy of America. Now, they were followed by another generation. And that generation is called the boomers, the baby boomers, and most of you have heard that phrase before, those born between 1946 and 1963 or 64. And they were the sons and daughters of builders. They They followed in their dad's footsteps. In most instances, they continued to build what it is their fathers had established, and they grew the economy. There are about another 60 million or so of those, making the total group of people between the builders and the boomers of about 125 million people. Now, what's really interesting about that is that those 125 million people represent about 80% of all the charitable giving in America today.
Now,
80%. So if you look at the larger picture of philanthropy in America in the 21st century, there was somewhere between 380 and 400 billion or something in that area of money that was given in America in 2015. So 80%, if you just take the 400 billion number, just for simple math, that means that $320 billion of the $400 billion was either given or driven by builders and boomers. In other words, they were making the decisions in relationship to charitable giving. And that was the case in 2015. Now, keep in mind that the age period now between builders and boomers is the oldest of the builders is about 91 years old now, and the youngest of the boomers is just turning 70. So here is a generation of people, 125 million strong, who are basically responsible for giving 80% of all the money that's being given in America today. Now, there's something that's happening, as you clearly know. They're getting older. They're retiring. They're retiring at the rate of about 10,000 a day, and that's a process that's going to continue for the next 10 to 12 years. They're dying at the rate of about 1,500 a day. And so as they retire and as they die, obviously there's going to be less money available that basically much of you or many of you have been receiving from various sources from the West. And so that's significant to know, and we're going to kind of develop that thought a little bit later. But let me tell you about the next three generations after that. Because following the boomers are the busters. Now, we call them the X generation, but it's the generation of people that were born between approximately 1964 and 1980. So there's only about 40 million of them, and they give about 12% of all the money that's being given in America. So we've got 80% given by the builders and the boomers, and 12%, so now we have 92% of the giving that is taking place in our country today is taking place by those three generations. But 45 million busters is not going to pick up the difference that's going to be lost by the builders and boomers as they die and retire. They're basically giving now probably what it is that they're going to be giving. I mean, they're in their 50s and 60s. They're moving into that middle age group, and most of their giving habits are already pretty established. And so they're followed by the Y and the Z generations. Now, the Y generation is those that were born between 1980 and 2000. And there are a lot of Y gens here in the forum. This is the younger group of people that were born, you know, during that era, and they're now taking their place and actively engaged in many ways in what it is that, you know, God is doing in the world today, and we have that to be encouraged by. They're followed by the Z generation, and the Z generation is essentially those born between 2000 and 2015. Now, they don't give much money because the oldest of them is only 15 years old. So you're not expecting an awful lot of money from them. But the combined total of those two generations, Y and Z, is about 125 or 130 million. So the same amount of people that were busters and boomers, you know, essentially Y and Z gens, and the busters and the boomers shaped the world, at least our world. And the millennials, the Y and Zs, are going to shape their world in much the same way or have the same level of impact on their world as their grandparents and their parents had on theirs. And therein lies a lot of concern because they're different. They're not like their parents or their grandparents. They have different values, and we're going to talk a lot about that a little bit later. But the whole point is that this is the big picture of what's happening in our country. And I realize that, you know, the same characteristics were not necessarily reflected perhaps in your country. But the realities are the same impact is taking place. In other words, the generation that now exists in Eastern Europe and in Western Europe and other places is not like the previous generation. They were almost like the Depression era people that basically went through wars and everything and lost about everything. They began to build, and now this generation has experienced a new level of life with new opportunities that have never been available to them before. They're taking full advantage of all of those opportunities. And the realities are they're going to shape their world, and they'll probably shape it in many ways better than what their fathers did in some instances, and that may be true in our country as well. But they're going to shape their world in the same way that their parents shaped theirs. And so we can't assume that everything is going to remain the same. And that's one of the assumptions that we make oftentimes. Albert Einstein, and he's one of a number of people who basically are taking credit for the statement that you're all familiar with. You can't continue to do the same thing in the same way and expect different results. Now, whether it was Einstein or you that said that, the realities are we know it's true. That doing the same thing in the same way and expecting different results is not going to make the changes that need to take place if we're going to reach and impact a generation with a message of Jesus' love. And that's what we're all about at the ultimate end, is really making an impact, a kingdom impact, you know, in our generation. So here are some of the things that have happened, and we're going to give you some more specific characteristics as it relates to the various generations and some of the characteristics, especially of the millennials, that I think you'll find to be interesting. But by and large, we're seeing some things that are very encouraging. There are more, and you're going to be perhaps a bit surprised by this, but there are more millennials per capita that give than builders and boomers. In other words, they don't give as much money, but there are more of them individually that give than their fathers and grandfathers, which tells us that they are interested, they are exposed to the world, they have seen need, and they wanted to respond to need. And that's very commendable. I grew up in the state of Maine, and Maine is on the northeast corner of the United States, and it's an area that's beautiful, and essentially, if you've had a Maine lobster, or if you've had a lobster that came from the east or from the west, it probably was a Maine lobster because we are known for, you know, that fishing industry. My father was a lobsterman. My grandfather was a lobsterman. My uncles were lobstermen. My cousins are lobstermen. I get horribly seasick, and so I'm not and was not and would never be a lobsterman. But the realities are they worked really extremely hard. And in the case of my family, they were basically that was their world. In my case, growing up, when I was 15, I don't think I had ever left the state of Maine. I thought that Maine was the center of the universe. And then all of a sudden, I realized that the world was much bigger than that. We never traveled. My parents had giving habits. Both my parents were, and my wife's parents were Christians, and they were tithers. They gave to their church, and they gave to, you know, a couple of other, many of them gave to missionaries because there was this big, large missionary movement during that era, and people were raising support to go and to serve the Lord. And so they gave to a lot of those people, and then they gave to maybe one other organization, and that was their giving habits. And that's what they did all of their lives. I remember when my parents died, we were kind of going through receipts and things that they had done, and we noticed that they had been giving to one organization probably for 40 years. And everybody, I mean, they just expected, it was probably a $10 gift or a $20 gift, it wasn't that much, but they were sending that every single month to this one organization. And they were doing that to two or three different organizations, but their larger contributions obviously were to the church. So that was their habit. And essentially, that was a habit that my wife and I adopted because her parents did pretty much the same thing. And so our largest giving is to our church because we believe in the concept of the tithe, and we basically give first to our church, and then we give to some missionaries that we're supporting. And then one organization that we particularly believe in called Compassion International, and we donate generously to that organization. But that's pretty much our giving habits. We give to needs as they come aware to us. So someone's going to go on a short-term missions trip, and we might help them with that or whatever the case might be. But that's pretty much our tradition. But it's different among the millennials. Most of them have passports. Now, I don't know how old you are, but I think I was probably 35 years old when I got my first passport. Most of these young people today have passports already, and many of them are just infants. They just got their passport because their parents travel everywhere and they need a passport. Their children need a passport just like they do. And so they travel around the world. They've got lots of stamps in their passport because they've been to a lot of places, and those stamps represent the places where they've been. And they take great pride in showing you that. They've experienced more than what we ever did. My world was the state of Maine. Their world is the world. You know, they travel to places, they see needs, they respond to needs, and so forth. And so, you know, the world has changed. Per capita giving among millennials is higher than the builders and the boomers, but the average size gift is significantly lower because they're giving, but they're giving to more things because they've been exposed to more opportunities. And so, you know, that is going to mean that we're going to have to make some changes. And we're going to talk a little bit about what those changes might look like in a succession or the next session. But let's just talk about the boomers or the builders and the boomers real quickly as we conclude this particular section. The greatest opportunity in philanthropy today is in terms of larger contributions is going to be among the builders and the boomers. It's estimated that $60 trillion is going to be transferred between generations in the next 20 to 30 years. As builders and boomers, it's going to be a generational transfer of money that's going to come from builders and boomers that's going to be transferred to their children or to other organizations like yours. And so the greatest opportunity in the world today in terms of philanthropy is really engaging builders and boomers in making legacy gifts, which they're deeply concerned about. I mean, we're all concerned. The older you get, the more you're concerned about your legacy. You want to leave evidence of the fact that you were here and that you were making a difference. And so legacy giving is really, you know, the most important thing that to focus on in your work. I'm not suggesting that you ignore your builders and boomers and what it is they're doing now if you're getting money from the West, but realize that the realities are that money is going to go away, and it's going to go away in the next 10 or 20 years where most of those people will have either, you know, died or are much, much older. And so one of the focuses that I would really encourage you to think about is presenting opportunities wherein people can participate through a legacy gift to your organization. Now, legacy giving kind of falls into two categories. There are people that are extremely wealthy, and there are people that are not extremely wealthy. The numbers that are extremely wealthy is probably in the 10 to 15% range of the entire populous group. The majority of people are not really very wealthy, but many of them all of them have some level of an estate that basically would be settled at the time of their death. Unfortunately, in the world of philanthropy, there has been a disproportionate focus upon the 15% that have the most money, almost to the ignoring, you know, the 85%, you know, that don't have a lot of money, and so we tend to kind of neglect them. Now, the ones that have a lot of money, there are a lot of creative things that they can do with that money. There are things that can be tax-saving things. There are ways that they can use insurance to replace money that they might want to give. There's all kinds of tools that are available to them that are not available to people that aren't wealthy. And so the focus is, let's go to those people, almost, again, to the expense of the others. But the greatest opportunity among builders and boomers is among that 85% or the remaining group of people who basically don't have as much money, but they do have an estate. And so in encouraging people that you know, and you probably have a pretty good idea of the ages of people that essentially are represented among your constituency. But one of the easiest and the most painless of all gifts is a bequest. You see, you know, my estate is relatively small. I mean, in America, it's in relatively small. I mean, it may be, you know, $500,000 or $600,000, and that's basically mostly in real estate that we own, and in some things that we have and money that we've saved. But it's not an awful lot of money. But I could say to you, I want to give your organization $100,000. And I say, I want to make that a legacy gift because I really believe in what your organization is doing. And I want to give you $100,000. When Sue and I pass away, you know, what's left of our estate, we want to distribute it, but we want to distribute a significant portion of that to support something that we really believed in. Now, if I make that commitment, how am I going to live tomorrow? Just the way I live today. It's the largest gift I've ever given or would have ever given to anything at one time. But I'm going to live, you know, the way I'm living now. It's not impacting my lifestyle, but it is impacting the kingdom of God. Because you would get $100,000 at my death, and you're going to have to wait for it for a while, hopefully a long while, but maybe not as long as I might think. But the realities are that money would come to you. And if you multiply that times 100 or 200 or 500 or 1,000, I mean, we're talking about, you know, 65,000 people that basically are in the category, maybe a little bit more because they're still builders that, you know, are still very, very active in their work. But a large proportion of those people, you know, could make a significant gift. And it could be $5,000, it could be $10,000, it could be $250,000, it may be the entire state. But we need to be talking in your letters. You know, here you can make a legacy gift. And let me tell you what a legacy gift would mean for us as we continue to grow this ministry. And this ministry will go on until the time that Jesus comes back again. So the greatest opportunity today is basically in the area of, from my perspective, in raising the large amounts of money that we need to raise, you know, to continue to grow what it is that we're doing. Is going to be in legacy giving.